with that out of the way, I'll do it again. All right. Well, that. Welcome to GCP Bytes, episode number 12 for Friday, the 14th of March, 2025. GCP Bytes is a podcast where we discuss Google Cloud and tech. And I'm your host, Stephen Bancroft. On today's show, Google bug bounties and layoffs, NBN chooses Kuiper, Broadcom is actually looking good, and what's the problem with AI deepfakes in the AI wars? But before we get to any of that, I'd like to introduce the co-hosts of the show, Dave Wall. How are you, Dave?
I'm doing pretty good, thanks, mate. Glad to be here.
Excellent, excellent. And fresh from the wind and the rain and the cyclonic conditions, it's our very own GDE, Ian Brown. How are you, Ian, besides being wet?
If you'd asked me that on the weekend, a little damp.
Yeah, so just for our listeners, give us the TLDR about what's been going on in Southeast Queensland.
So Cyclone Alfred came down off the coast, about 500 kilometres off the coast, hovered around Southeast Queensland for, I don't know, 4 days, still off the coast, hadn't made landfall. Eventually hit Moreton Island, turned into a low-pressure system, and then dumped. I think between Friday and Monday last week, we got over 500 mil of rain.
Sheesh.
Realistically, I know that Brisbane and northern New South Wales absolutely copped it with the wind and the rain as well. We didn't. We're on the sunny coast. We only really copped the rain. And lots and lots and lots of flooding up here.
And the beaches, a lot of the beaches were destroyed as well. They're all eroded away, yeah.
Yeah, there's some photos that I've seen of Main Beach on the Gold Coast with like a 2 metre drop-off.
Yeah, and they're beginning some repairs on that now. They're going to do sand pumping. Apparently they have a barge and they suck the sand up and then shoot it all back onto the beach.
Yeah.
So
yeah, yeah.
It'd be cool to see that, yeah.
That's how they built the runway at Sunshine Coast Airport.
Yeah, right.
They pumped 350,000 cubic metres of sand out of Moreton Bay and pumped it onto the land. Yeah.
Cool. So I guess no tech adventures for you then.
No, not really. I've got lots of cleanup.
Plumbing adventures.
Plumbing adventures.
No, I've got lots of cleanup to do. There's lots and lots of dirt and silt is washed down the driveway and sort of collected on the level area on my driveway. My driveway is about 100 metres long, as you know, Banky, and there's probably a good 2 inches of dirt sitting at the bottom flat area. And the only other adventure would be my young fella surfing the water going down the paddock.
Hilarious.
Maybe you have to, rig yourself up a little dozer blade on your patrol, and then you can just go and push all that silt away.
Getting to it might be the hard bit. It's all currently sitting underneath my caravan. So, yay.
Well, no real tech adventures from me. We're doing a little bit of building works here at the moment, and
Taj Mahal that you've been building there.
Taj Mahal that I'm building. Yeah, we've had the builders through here and doing this and that.
It's not Taj Mahal. It's the Royal Banky.
The Royal. The Royal. That's it. Yeah. We've got two pumps in the pool. One's for the heater and one's for the actual chlorinator, right? And we'd had the heater disconnected because it had some pipelines that go up to the roof, and it's a solar thing with the heating elements on the roof, right? And we had that disconnected while we were doing the works on the side of the house. Anyway, they reconnected it all back up. And I went, right, okay, well, I better go and open the valves up and get the pump going and test it all. So I went under the house, and, of course, the way I've got both the pumps set up is just with those Whiz things you get from Bunnings, right, the home automation system.
Right? Okay, yep.
And, of course, when I disconnected it,
like over a month ago. I just pulled it out and left it hanging there. And of course, since that time, we'd taken the, there was a cover over the pool. Believe it or not, this pool was enclosed and we've taken that cover off now. And of course, when we did that, that allowed the water to come down and it must have got into the whiz plug.
Ooh.
And I just didn't think about this. And then I plugged the whiz plug back in. And then the moment, the instant I plugged it back in, bang, I got a shock off it.
Oy.
I saw a flash of light on the inside of it and then, like, part of the house was in darkness. Right. Okay. That's just shorted out. So, yeah.
And you were okay? Or?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Just mild electrocution, you know.
It wasn't the chair.
No, it wasn't the chair. But, yeah, I felt the zap in my hand, that's for sure. And, yeah, so... where it actually plugs in is fine because there's a little cover over it to stop the water getting onto it. But because I just pulled it out and had it hanging down, yeah. It filled up with water. And then when I took it off and inspected it more closely, yeah, there was a couple of little rust lines on the outside of it and the water had been running through it. And, yep, well, that goes in the bin.
Yep.
Got another one. So, yeah. And thankfully now I've got the pool heater pump all up and running and it's working great. Nice. So, yeah. That's my little tech story.
The outcome of the cyclone up here is we're getting a generator backup system in our house, like a permanently wired in ATS switched 9 kVA generator, so that the minute the power goes out, generator fires up and everything comes back online.
Right.
Brilliant.
You're going to run an essential circuit as well?
It's going to power the entire
essential
house. It's going to be a 9 kVA generator.
The entire house is essential.
The entire house is essential. Everything here.
Yeah, okay.
I want air conditioning, I want lights, I want fridging, I want internet. Yep.
You're going to keep a big strategic reserve of diesel on-prem?
Yes. So I've already got a 44-gallon drum in the shed with a hand crank on it. So all we're going to do there is move that to a location up beside the house where the generator is going to sit. And the generator that I'm going to buy is off some mates of mine who build industrial generators down in Brizzy. And the tank that it's got on it has an auto rotator in the tank. So it just turns the fuel over constantly. It's just a little pump in there that just cycles the fuel over. So diesel doesn't go off if you keep moving it.
Yeah, it doesn't go off. Yeah. Cool. Oh, that's anything from you, Dave? Anything interesting?
Nothing that would be worth chatting about.
Nothing worthy. All right. Well, on that note, then, how about we get on with the community news? And a little quiet on the community front this week, but I thought I'd throw in a story about Google bug bounties. Google on Friday, this is a story on Security Week and was published on 10th of March, they're saying on Friday announced paying $11.8 million in bug bounties to 660 researchers who reported security flaws via its vulnerability reward program in 2024. $11.8 million. I think we talked about the bug bounty scheme in previous episodes. According to the internet giant, it has awarded more than $65 million in bug bounty rewards since establishing its first vulnerability reward program in 2010. Pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I love the numbers that they come up with, though. So Google in 2024 revamped its reward structure with bounties up to $151,515. It's just a random number of 15s.
Yeah, there was an award which was 1337, which is
Elite
or something. But I was trying to figure out what 151515 means.
I don't know. I haven't had time this morning to have a look at it to try and figure out what it was. But yeah, and that's just for the Google and the cloud reward program, and there's up to 300,000 for mobile. And up to 250,000 for Chrome.
Right.
So
Yeah, nice. I'm just Googling the... I'm saying, what does 151515 mean? It says, it's simply a numeric value.
Doesn't mean anything. It's just a coincidence.
It means $151,515 dues.
Well, that's the AI overview telling me that.
Yeah, right.
It'd be, gee, it'd be more dollary dues because that's US dollars.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's right. Well, no, US dollars are dollary dues.
No.
No, it's a kangaroo.
Australian dollars are dollary dues.
Nah.
$900 dues.
It's not a binary number or a hex number, is it?
Might be a hex number.
No, there's nothing special about it in hex. There doesn't seem anything special about it in binary.
You're going down a numerology rabbit hole.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's looking for mysteries where there are
all sorts of really cool little numbers that they have. Like, they've got the domain 1e100.net, which is the number for a Google is 1e100, so it's one with 100 zeros.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, here we go.
He found it.
Specifics. The maximum reward based on a base amount of $101,010 for an RCE remote code execution vulnerability in their most sensitive products, with a 1.5 modifier applied for exceptional report quality, resulting in 151515 maximum.
Right.
So, and I'm guessing the 101010, I mean, that's clearly a reference to binary.
Yep.
For a remote code execution vulnerability, and then that's a 1.5 times multiplier.
Mystery solved.
Mystery solved, done.
So, move on. So what does 101010 mean in decimal? Do you know what it is?
It is the number of
the meaning of life.
Oh, it's a 42.
A 42,
it's 42.
Is it?
Ah, yeah. There we go.
Solved.
There you go.
Yeah.
Mystery solved. Look at us being sweats online.
I don't want to have to go back and work out binary numbers in my head. That takes me back to
that's what Google's
the
for.
Old subnetting in binary.
Yeah, working out your netmask, converting it to binary, and no thanks. No, that brings back nightmares.
42, so it is. Wow. Okay. Google are paying out some money. You can get a part of that if you find a bug in Google Cloud or a CVE. Then, you can get a piece of the pie.
Great programs, though, these.
Mm. They are. Makes wanting to report the vulnerabilities an actual thing, as opposed to people being scared of reporting vulnerabilities. There's lots of companies out there that if you report a vulnerability to them, they take you to court for hacking their software.
Hacking,
That's right. So,
it also, you know, stops you from being like, hey, I've worked out how to do this thing because for fun. Like, well, let's go make some money out of that.
Exactly. Mm. And there's guys that's all they live on. They literally just make money off Google and Amazon and all the big tech companies hacking their software.
Finding vulnerabilities, absolutely. Yep. All right, then. That's all we have for community this week, so let's get on with the news items. And first news item this week is some people movements, and not the way that you think. Google has announces layoff in its HR cloud units as part of ongoing cost cuts.
The people movement, people are moving.
I was up at 5:30 this morning. Give me a break.
Yep.
Although you've only had 3 hours sleep, I can't complain.
I'm not firing real well. Migration last night.
Yep.
Or should I say this morning?
Such is the way of this job. Google's people operation, its humans relations division, has offered buyouts to US-based employees. The company this week also laid off some employees in its cloud staff planning and reinvest its savings to hires in critical sales and engineering roles. Top priorities would be to drive more customers. Learn to speak. I only do a podcast. Cost-cutting as Google expands its spending on AI infrastructure.
Now, I take a little bit of issue with the second point there about laying off people in their sales and engineering roles. There's a bit of the article where it says that some affected roles will be relocated to India and Mexico, according to people familiar with the matter. Google's support is already pretty garbage these days, from an end user perspective, and so they're trying to make it worse. Well, they're not trying to make it worse, but they are inadvertently making it worse and not better for their customers. I understand that they're trying to save money; that's great. But if you can't support your customers, then I'm sorry, you're doing the wrong thing. Like, as an example, I put in a ticket to Google about the performance of M3 versus M1 instances. Mm-hmm. And I detailed out there, like, all the steps I'd gone to test it, like 32 CPU versus a 40 CPU M1. How come the M3 is much newer, like a 5-year newer CPU? I would expect the performance of the M3 to be better, even with less cores. And it's certainly Google's expectation, as is written in their docs, but it's not.
Mm.
So, and then you get some support person who comes back and completely mangles what you've asked and repeats.
Doesn't understand it, repeats
back to you some mangled version of what you've asked, and then goes, oh, if I don't have this correct, then please let me know. So you go back and correct them, and then they mangle it again and send it back to you. And this goes on 3 or 4 times. It's not like I've explained a difficult problem here or ill explained a difficult problem. It's a sheer comprehension thing.
So, and what would you be looking for though as a rectification there? Would you be more like waiting for them to come back and say, oh yes, to make use of say the newer instruction sets or cache qualities of the M3 chips, this is how you should change a few things? Or
I would expect that Google comes back and says, hey, yeah, look, the way that you're using it or the way that you've got the VM configured or what, like, give me some information as to how do I actually utilize this M3 to its fullest potential, because the M1 is currently flogging it in terms of performance. So we've currently got a database server that is an M140. It's our primary database server. And our secondary one, which was supposed to be an M3 with 32 CPUs, is now an M3 with 64 CPUs to equal the speed that we're getting out of the M1 with 40 CPUs.
Doesn't make sense, does it?
No, it doesn't. So and that's the thing, is you go around in this circle of, hey, is this what I understood you said? No. This is what I said. Hey, is this what I understood you said? No. This is what I said.
Yeah. Hey, do you have a best practices doc for how I should be, squeezing the performance out of this thing?
Like, is there some metric that, or some configuration that I have got wrong here?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it is a higher core speed, right?
Yeah.
M3.
It's the CPU is literally 5 years newer generation than the M1. I can't remember the actual Icy Lake versus whatever lake it is that they're supposed to be, but the M1 is a 5 year older chip than the M3. I'm sure Dave's looking it up right now.
I'm just trying to see if there's what new instruction sets and stuff that are in there. Or if you need to take into account things like, efficiency and performance cores, but I'm not sure what they use on the underlying there.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Well, let me have a look.
Well, anyway, that's a bit of a tangent. But
just a smidge.
We're going down a slight side road that's turned into a highway.
But I guess the point is reducing sales and engineering roles isn't going to help this situation, right?
No, that's right.
They're adding more sales and engineering. They're getting rid of ops and HR.
That's right, and that's exactly what I was about to say. As part of the HR buyouts, employees who are level 4 and 5 may receive, I mean, it's a good package, may receive 14 weeks of salary and one additional week for every full year served, the memo says.
That's fine.
They're considered mid to senior level employees. I think I read in this article, probably another article we're going to read later, is they've also suspended their DEI practices.
Yeah.
And are no longer
Google's aborted that completely.
As a lot of US companies have, along with the US government. Anyway, let's talking about tech billionaires. MBM Co. Set to choose Amazon over Musk's Starlink for satellite service. Now, this is a bit of a pivot.
It is.
And, you know, let's not go down that rabbit hole.
We'll put the elephant in the room over there.
Put the elephant away.
Yeah.
And let's just talk about NBN here and the fact that I think it's good. It's certainly better than the old lagging SkyMuster system. They need some sort of low Earth orbit internet system.
Indeed, and this is them looking at the SkyMuster sats were, they are scheduled to be sort of decommissioned around like 2032. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they served a purpose of having, you know, if you're very remote, this is a last effort sort of service. We can get you something, but there's only so much you can do with a geostationary sat, right? Like 65,000 kilometers away, that latency is pretty brutal.
That's a killer.
And there's just no way that Australia or an Australian company is going to launch its own low Earth orbit constellation, right? We don't have that kind of capital.
It's interesting that you said it's like really remote properties. A friend of mine who lives in Montville can't get any sort of landline, so they're on Starlink because they had SkyMuster and it was horrendous.
Yeah. It's 70s and 80s technology, right? And it just hasn't been updated, really refreshed since then.
No.
Well, okay. I mean, it's that satellite's not from the 80s, right? It was launched.
It's not. But you 10 know what
years
I mean?
Ago,
like, it could have been.
Well,
you know? It hasn't really changed much.
But I like the Kuiper solution that Amazon's come up with. When I was looking up the Starlink system, they've got about 7,500 satellites in the air at the moment. I think from memory. Don't quote me on that one.
It's because they are still launching so rapidly. I've completely lost track.
And they're also falling much more rapidly as well. So they're right. obsoleting a whole heap of the really early ones.
Yeah.
Right. As they replace them with newer ones. So
they wanted about 10,000, didn't they?
Yeah.
Ranged from, I think it was originally about 4, and then they wanted another band of about 7, and then I heard at one point they even asked for allocation for about 30,000 sats.
Yeah. The number, I just did a quick search on it. The number was supposed to be upwards of 30,000. They've made, just having a look at the number of launches that they've done, and there's lots of them. 239 launches that they've done, and they've got currently 8,050 satellites launched. 987 of them have failed or deorbited. 7,095 are in orbit, and 7,063 are working satellites. Of those working satellites, 6,382 are operational. So there's a fair failure rate there. But what I like about the Kuiper project is it's only 3,000 satellites. So that's what they're planning for, 3,000 satellites in a low Earth orbit that's going to supply super fast, ultra low latency broadband. And the numbers that they quote, and I'm just on the Project Kuiper website because I found it really interesting. They haven't released costs on it. They have said that the speeds are going to be somewhere in the vicinity of 1 to 400 megasecond out of the system. And the it'll be much the same as the Starlink system where you buy the dish and off it goes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and so, like, they will be launching soon, right? They're very keen. They want to get into this space. There's certainly sovereign risks in only having Starlink as the only game in town, with elephant aside. I mean, I think this is very prudent for NBN to be looking like, okay, there's no point us investing in Starlink for this service. It exists already. It's there regardless. We don't need to be doing anything on that, right? It's still available for people to get. If you want Starlink, it is there.
You
right?
can go get it, yeah.
Right? So we need another solution. Why don't we pack and go, okay, well, Kupi is going to be operational before then. That sounds like a pretty valid backstop for us. And because, reading this article, they mentioned that, you know, Australia will be one of the earlier markets where this is available. And again, this is because they'll be covering the US and we're in the opposite side of the earth. So we get the same sats.
We just get it by default. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that NBN or the government has gone down this path too, because I know for a fact that most of the Navy ships have got Starlink. It's their go-to for internet access on a Navy ship because, you know, your Inmarsat and all that, like all those geostationary satellite systems are slow and latent and all the rest of it. You can't do video calls or anything like that.
So they've got to around. I mean, they've moved pretty quickly to deck out all the Navy with those.
Oh, yeah. And I know.
Because well, there's also
– I've got a mate of mine who
there's another service as well. There's Starlink, but there's also Star Shield, which is targeted at defense.
Yeah.
So this is from SpaceX as well, but it is the defense side of
defense,
it.
It's defense version. I've got a mate of mine who runs an oil rig off WA, and they've got Starlink, so they've got their standard comms. Gear which uses like the Inmarsat or whatever that geostationary one is that they're using, and that's all approved and everything, and it's got its own firewalls and all that. And then he's just got a new Starlink unit, so they've got two now. They've got their initial Starlink unit, and then they've got the new one that's just come out. And the company that he works for, which shall remain nameless, shipped him the dish. Like, it has to go up to Broom and then get on a helicopter to go out to the rig, but didn't send him the little firewall that comes with it because they needed to do security testing on the firewall.
Right.
And two different generations of Starlink gear, so one's not compatible with the other. You can't plug that dish, that new dish, into the old router because they run on different voltages or something like that. And so...
It's like, but, great, thanks. Send me another helicopter, please.
Yeah. I mean, they've got helicopters going out there at least once a week, so
yeah, it's not that, next run, yeah.
But it's like a 3-hour flight.
Yep.
But yeah, look, it's interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing Project Kuiper come out because I want to see, A, how much it costs, like for the infrastructure and for the actual service, because if it's decent enough, I might actually give it a wallop with the... with our caravan.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, it'd be worth giving it a go.
I did read here that their standard plan is 100 to 400 megabits per second, and they can deliver up to 1 gigabit per second.
Yeah, I mean, that does remain to be seen, like, once the reality kicks in, though, right, because the service isn't due to sort of start being available till 2026, so... They can have their plans. We've got to see when the actual rubber hits the road.
Right. And will the speed decrease if there's more congestion on it?
Yep.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, they will.
Yeah. And, you know, whether or not initially they are able to use, like, laser interconnects or if they're going to be sort of bent piping, as you know, Starlink was doing for most locations, like Laserlink's available now. But for most of the time that it's been available, it's just been, you know, basically bouncing you down to a ground station.
Yeah. They say here on the Amazon's Kuiper site that they're deploying the satellite constellation early 2025 with the service rolling out later this year. So maybe we might get I might get it later the year.
Maybe.
And I guess the thing is, if it's being provided, if it's becoming part of the NBN network, then you could just go to Aussie Broadband and it'll just be packaged in with like someone like Aussie Broadband or whoever is the NBN retailer, right? You won't even really see the fact that it's been that it's the Kuiper system, right?
Mm. Yeah, I suppose it depends on how they're going to do their retail operations. So, you know, Starlink, you just get it, right? You get it directly from them,
yeah.
And now, I mean, initially you couldn't, but obviously as you did, Ian, you know, you can now go to like a caravan store and buy the dishes there. But initially, you know, you just did it all online. You had to wait for it all to be shipped out. So
from the US.
Whether or not with you know, QPR, they go that way and they'll be like, well, we will just have like retail partners in country.
QPR or Kuiper?
No, it's Kuiper. It's named after the Kuiper belt.
It's Kuiper. Named after the Kuiper belt.
It was an internal, so I read a heap about it. It was an internal project named Project Kuiper after the Kuiper belt, which is, as we all know, the band of rocks that's in the outer solar system. And it's just stuck. So Amazon apparently are keeping it as Project Kuiper. I'm like, cool. But I wonder then if as is normal in Australia, we get some really cool service from the US and we throttle it. Like, is NBN going to take that service and go, oh, yeah, okay, we're going to give it to you for whatever price it is, but you're only going to get, you know, 50 megasecond out of it.
But why would they do that? I mean, you wouldn't buy it then. You'd just go and get a Starlink service.
Because, remember, they're still charging CVCs on this.
Mm.
Yeah, they're still charging you fees, like the connectivity fees that gets them out of their network.
I guess we'll just see when it comes.
Yeah. All right. Moving on, some freebies. Google,
we like a freebie.
We like a freebie. Code Assist, now available for free for individuals to use, Gemini Code Assist. Google has announced a public preview of a free version of its AI coding assistant, Gemini Code Assist, for individual users, according to a post on the Google Cloud blog.
180,000 code completions per month.
Yeah,
that's a lot. Staggering, hey?
That's good.
Yeah, that's good. And that compares to typically around 2,000 on other assistants.
And it's powered by Gemini 2.0, which is even better because that's the latest model.
I had a bit of a look in my code earlier. How do you set this up? Because I've currently got still the Duet AI linking back to, you know, a project. Do I need to remove that? How do I go about setting this up?
It's still there. You should see the Gemini. So if you're using VS Code, you should see the Gemini icon in the left hand side of VS Code. If you've got the plugin installed,
on the left or the right, or the bottom right.
Oh, but no. On the left hand taskbar, there should be Gemini Code Assist.
Oh, right.
And there's
There
is actually a new extension for it. But the Google Cloud Code is the actual extension that does the work in VS Code. And, yeah, you've still got to select a project. Reminds me, I've got to set that up at work today.
Says here, you are missing a valid license for Gemini Code Assist. Please contact your billing administrator. Maybe it's because I'm on the work.
Yeah, possibly. I've got mine set up under my personal one because I'm a trusted tester. Incidentally, the settings in VS Code are still Duet AI dot whatever the setting is. So they haven't changed
it. Yeah, right. Okay, I haven't changed that yet. Yeah, nice. So that'll use the code I have as my context.
Yep. Yeah, you can use. Nice. And the same thing applies. Like you can go into when you put the Gemini extension into VS Code in the left hand side, you can click on that and you can use Gemini directly and say, hey, give me this with relation to the code in this file.
Yes. So Google said the company's goal is to make AI available to all developers, regardless of their ability to pay, as the global developer population is expected to reach 57.8 million by 2028. So, I mean, that's good of them, right? I mean, the thing is, if you don't have, it's getting to the point, if you don't have this AI available to you, you're just going to be left behind.
Yeah, true.
I did like another call out from this article is Google's reducing the time spent on code reviews with the public preview of Gemini Code Assist for GitHub. So you'll be able to integrate Gemini Code Assist into GitHub PRs to auto review for you.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So no more LGTM.
No.
LGTM send it. No. Just get the AI to do that for you.
Yep.
Oh boy. I can.
AI taking over the world.
I can see the outages already. I can see the outages.
My AI written code, my AI approved PR. Yeah.
Foreshadowing outages.
Let's see if we can get Gemini to have a conversation with itself inside of GitHub PRs about the code quality.
Just arguing with itself.
I have got 129 pages PDF of Gemini talking to itself about how its code suggestions are really helpful, and here's some more helpful tips to itself. And then, oh, thanks for those tips. Here's some more tips that I found as well. It just
how about you load up a gem for the your code reviewer and go and pretend you are Linus Torvalds.
You stole my joke. Let's hope they haven't used Linus Torvalds' emails as training data.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Could you imagine the expletives in your PR?
Oh, dear.
I do enjoy his emails on the kernel archives.
Oh, yeah. There's some crackers in there. All right. Let's move on. Google will still have to break up its business. The Justice Department says it will have to sell Chrome, but it can continue investing in AI.
This is an odd one. So just quote a little bit from the article. When the Department of Justice argued for its sale last year, it said that selling Chrome will permanently stop Google's control of this critical search access point and allow rival search engines the ability to access the browser. For many users, it's a gateway to the internet. And I'd argue that point in that Google Chrome is not the gateway to the internet because it's not the default browser on any operating system that's ever installed anywhere. It is always the one that you have to manually install yourself.
This is true.
So,
but what about phones, right? Like iPhone, for instance.
So
still Safari, right? Yes, yeah.
So I don't think it's a gateway even on a phone. Like an iPhone, the default browser there on all Apple gear is Safari.
Safari.
On Windows machines, it's always Edge. On Linux machines, it's always Firefox.
So I would hazard that Google's lawyers would have put that case forward, and given the fact that we're still at this point, was obviously found to be lacking.
Yeah.
Which, surprising.
Yeah. Yeah. But the other one that I found in this one was a bit interesting was the proposal seeks to ban Google from paying companies like Apple, smartphone manufacturers. I'm suffering a banky's mangling of words. and Mozilla to make search engine the default on phones and browsers. So the question then becomes who's going to step in and take up that spot that Google's going to be left out of? And doesn't that...
Well, the question I had on that point, or the comment I had on that point, that'd be great if the other search engines were actually any good.
Well,
right. So there is that point, right? So that, what search engine is going to replace it, right?
DuckDuckGo, right. Baby.
Startpage.com.
Right? You know?
AltaVista.
AltaVista.com. Yeah. Like, come on. Like, seriously? Like.
Oh, no, it's Ask Jeeves with the steel chair.
Oh, Bing, that's right. We can always Bing things, can't we?
That's such a horrible term.
It's horrible. They're all garbage. Yeah. Let's just put it out there. They're all garbage. This is why the Google search engine is in the position it is, because it is clearly the best. When it came out in the 90s, it just blew everything out of the water, and they've still managed to keep themselves in that position.
Yeah. So,
I mean, there won't be any reason, I would guess, for Apple to say they don't have to necessarily change it. They just can't be paid for it. So they can go make a different decision about what would be their, say, the default search, whether or not they want to do their own thing, or they'll just, for some other reason, go, well, maybe, yeah, we'll continue to use Google because that's just what our customers expect.
Yeah.
They just won't be allowed to be paid for it.
No, you're right. You're right. And that's right. If it gets to that situation, then, you know, make the search engine easy to change and then get some data on it, and they'll probably find that, you know, users are changing the search engine to Google. Let's just make it the default anyway.
But, and so then that leaves a question of, these companies are currently paid squillions of dollars every year for that, hey, we're first, or we're the default search engine. That's going to leave, I mean, yeah, okay, Apple's probably not going to miss the millions of dollars that it's paid. Mozilla will.
I think it's about a billion.
Yeah, Mozilla definitely will. Like, it's an open source company. It relies solely on that sort of investment. So where does that leave companies like Mozilla? Is that going to completely bin Firefox as a browser?
It could be detrimental, couldn't it? Yeah. Because Firefox is the last stalwart of
it's not, you know, Chromium based.
Yeah, that's right. Internet diversity. Yeah.
And then the other part of that is, where does it leave other phone manufacturers out there? So you've got a myriad of Android phone manufacturers out there that Google would be paying to have the default browser set to Google. So. Where does that leave them? Because that would be a fair chunk of investment for them too. Because I don't like, okay, yeah, I can see Microsoft coming along and saying, hey, here's $1 billion to make us the default search engine.
Well, they probably won't be allowed to.
Well, I don't know. Based off this. This order is only preventing Google from doing it. So... There's no reason why Microsoft couldn't step in, and likely will step in and do that. And then how many users are just going to go, stuff it. I'll use Bing now because that's the default and I can't be bothered changing it.
Or, as you've seen before, they won't even realize because the Bing main page looks like the Google search page, and they won't even know.
Yeah. Well, actually, if you go to startpage.com, it looks like Google too, so...
Yeah. So, I mean, that's weird. That's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, on the surface, it does seem like anti-competitive and they wanted to tip the balance in favour. But you're right. The money is propping up these smaller initiatives that's keeping the diversity in the industry, right? And keeping you know, things like Firefox alive.
Yeah. So the only reason why they've removed the ability for Google to invest in AI startups is because Anthropic went to the Department of Justice and went, if we don't have Google's funding, we don't exist.
Same argument.
Yeah. Same argument.
And Firefox could step up and make that argument as
that's
well.
That's right. And yeah. I think what you'll find is a lot of that will get, like, that's been squashed. That's proposal's been removed because of that exact thing, and because the US government is dependent on Anthropic for stuff.
Right.
How the wheel turns in the hamster cage.
Yeah, how the wheel turns, yeah. And this is the article too, which does just, I don't want to get into the weeds, but it says Google donated to the Trump campaign when he ran last year and recently halted efforts to hire employees from diverse backgrounds.
Yeah.
So we're not too pleased about that particular item either.
Yeah, look, Google are doing what Google does best. They're following the political narrative.
All right, well, let's move on to another very interesting article that's come our way about Broadcom. As much as we bag Broadcom and everyone's hating it, Broadcom seems to have won. Broadcom has won 70% of large VMware customers bought its biggest bundle. Broadcom's acquisition, an article in the Register here, Broadcom's acquisition of VMware appears to be a big success. On the balance sheet, at least, after the company announced a big majority of its top 10,000 customers have decided to acquire its cloud foundation stack and posted strong growth.
This comes as no surprise to me. If you are a large enterprise and you are embedded in VMware, the migration path to put something else in its place and the learning curve on your staff is astronomical.
Sure. All right. And I agree. However, I consider this to be a Pyrrhic victory because if you look across at Nutanix, which is another very expensive solution, right? Yep. Like Nutanix HCI is a top tier product.
Yeah.
Right. Very strong growth.
Okay.
Right. Since this whole VMware change has gone across. So their top line numbers are doing well because they've, you know, managed to upsell a bunch of their customers, but they're bleeding customers, right? Oh, the numbers are higher, but you're losing customers. Nutanix is very strong growth. We've seen, you know, for smaller implementations, Proxmox moving up the stack and other solutions like Harvester, right, becoming way more common now. So seeing those other hypervisors taking off and like Veeam, for example, now supporting Proxmox. Like a lot of people love Veeam for backup and, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think they see this now. And sure, maybe they'll continue to see like good numbers going forward, but I don't think it would be what they would have had.
Oh no! Right? No, like definitely not.
The amount of win that's now in all these other competitors' sales, which is great, right? Like a diverse market, but yeah,
I think more than anything, I wasn't surprised that they'd kept a lot of their big customers in this. To be honest, when I first read it, I was probably a little bit surprised that it was as high as 70%. I would have thought that they would have kept 50 or 60%, maybe, but. But I'm not surprised that of their top 10,000 biggest customers that they've kept up a large majority, because you and I, all of us, we've done these migrations. We know how embedded these guys are in VMware, and how the thought of learning something new is scary.
Yeah, and look, I guess my thinking on this as well is effectively the first cycle of this, right? Mm. And a lot of these companies, you're right, that these big enterprises, the speed they move is glacial, right? And to be able to like suddenly pivot and say, right, we're just going to move everything on the Proxmox, or we've all been involved in migrations into a hyperscaler environment, right? Mm. It doesn't happen at the click of a finger, right? They already had like their sort of 12-month scheduling and the capacity planning already in place, and it's just easier to cough up and pay the bill, right? Rather than just pivot overnight.
And the other part of that is that there is in order to migrate from a VMware platform to something else, there is a large capital investment required, or there is at least a capital investment required, because you've got to think that whilst the recommendation is that you only sort of utilize 70% of the environment, most environments are well over the 70% utilization. We've seen it.
They've been 90-95%,
or they're so over provisioned.
Nodes crash constantly.
Yeah, that's right. So in order to migrate off VMware to something else, you've got to have capacity there on that something else to do it. And you can't do that if you're at 90% utilization. Even at 70%, I say that you're probably only sparing one or two hosts, and that's not enough to build a production system.
And sure, right? Like, and if you are looking at your existing platform and you go, okay, well, our nodes are about 5 years old, so we'll go buy new nodes to build the new system, but it's going to be a long time before we can do the migration. Well, all right. We know what a VMware to VMware migration looks like.
Yep.
All right. So, yeah, as what I'm saying is I think this is an over time thing. I don't think it was like, yep, in 18 months' time, we're going from, you know, 1,000 VMware nodes to 1,000 Harvester nodes, right? Like, that's not going to happen. You're not going to see an in-place like that. But you will see a lot more pilot projects, and you will see in a lot more smaller companies, which will turn into bigger companies over time, starting with a different solution.
Oh, 100%. I think that we'll see, in the course of 5 years, I think this, even probably next year, this number will be vastly different.
That's right. Yeah, it's going to be a slow burn.
I think there's certainly for big companies, there is a massive learning curve on their infrastructure engineers or their hypervisor people and storage people to migrate to a new technology and learn it and learn its idiosyncrasies. We've been using VMware for so long now, we know its idiosyncrasies. We know what not to do.
You know where to look in the particular log files on nodes and things.
Yeah. Versus if I threw a VMware admin into Proxmox or into Harvester or into any of the other hypervisor solutions, Zen Server or something like that, they'd be scratching their head for days, weeks, or months.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, especially for a lot of the, you know, like Windows admins, like Windows on VMware, right? They'll have very minimal Linux skills.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, Harvester, well, you're dealing in SUSE, right?
So. Yeah. Yeah, or you're building it yourself on RHEL or Debian or something like that.
Roll your own. Yeah. Now, Broadcom doesn't publish actual figures for VMware per se, but we can say the jump from $1.97 billion software revenue in Q4 2023 to $6.7 billion in Q1 2025 is likely due to VMware, which in its last quarter as an independent company reported $3.4 billion. Therefore, it looked like Broadcom added around $1 billion to quarterly VMware revenue in a little over a year. Not bad. With that out of the way, let's get on with the AI Wars.
AI Wars.
Google reports scale of complaints about AI deepfake terrorism content to Australian regulator. Now, where do we start with this one?
I didn't read this article because I could only get like a paragraph and then it all just had chopped off for me.
I don't know, nothing. I do have it. Google has informed the Australian, let's see, it's an article on IT News. Google has informed the Australian authorities it received more than 250 complaints globally over nearly a year that its artificial intelligence software was used to make deepfake terrorism material. The tech giant also said, and this is the most concerning bit, said it has received dozens of user reports warning that its AI program Gemini was being used to create child abuse material, according to the Australian eSafety Commissioner. Now, this is because under Australian law, tech firms must supply the eSafety Commissioner periodically with information about harm minimisation efforts or risk fines. So they have to report this stuff.
Yeah. And look, I think this is interesting because I would say that if people are using Gemini to create this stuff, they're also using all of the others to create this stuff. There's heaps of models out there that will create this far better than Google will, because Google's...
And you can roll your own without any safeguards.
That's right. Gemini has got so many guardrails around it, it's not funny. And I think anything that it does create here that is terroristic in threat, in nature, is probably minimal at best. The one that concerns me is the child exploitation stuff, because, you know, that's just weird. And I would suggest that it's also probably not anywhere near as bad as that. It's just in that classification.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm starting to see you're in your social media, you're just scrolling through, having a look, doing a bit of doom scrolling, right, as we all do. And the odd video comes up every now and then, and I'm on some martial arts forums and stuff in there, and the amount of crappy AI-generated videos that are being posted on there now, it's reached toxicity levels.
Oh, yeah.
It's just ridiculous. I've had, you know, a couple of angry unfollows for those groups. It's like, why are you posting this garbage?
It's slop.
It's slop, yeah. It really is. And it's obviously AI, right? And some people can't detect it. They don't realize it's AI. That's the scary thing.
Yeah, yeah. I think Facebook these days even labels things when it's quite blatantly AI generated. They will label it as this is an AI generated image or AI generated video. I don't know that their detection technology is all that great because it's not detecting some of the better stuff. But hey, that'll come about in time.
I mean,
it'll get better. Yeah.
Facebook is very weird though, where you'll get like this bizarre videos or images. I don't know. It's like Jesus with soldiers and it's so weird. It's like no one will share this image and it's got 48 million likes on it and all this random. It's like this is AI content shared by bots, commented on bots and given to my grandparents. Like this is
fed, shoveled to them. Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah, it's hideous.
The old controlling the narrative via social media.
Yeah.
How certain people win elections, I've heard. Allegedly.
Apparently. it does say at the end of this article, X has lost a court appeal because of its fine of $610,000, but plans to appeal again because it was public. It got caught with some violent and extremist material on X.
Yep. Which is sadly like, Twitter was once really, really good for news and all that sort of stuff. X is literally, if I jump onto X these days, it is the only thing I ever see on there is stuff about a certain president. Lots of OnlyFans content. And I don't follow any of that, so I don't know where it's coming from or why it's on my feed and various politicians in Australia.
Yeah, it's completely gone toxic.
Mm.
Completely.
I'm enjoying Blue Sky.
Yeah, I've not.
I haven't jumped on it for ages. I need to jump on and have a look.
I guess the moral of the story with this one is we're seeing more and more AI generated content on social media. There are people like us that are aware of it, and we're trying to clue all our listeners up to it as well, but there clearly is a large segment of the population that has no idea.
Yep.
So just be aware of that. Like, just look out for the markers. I know when I look at a video now, the first thing I look at is the hands.
Yeah.
The hands and the arms moving around, right? It's an obvious giveaway that it's an AI-generated thing. And things like things that are like got like ropes and knots and stuff like phalanges and stuff that's like that, like octopus legs and stuff, right? That's a giveaway, right? Like you just can't generate that kind of thing properly.
I saw, speaking of the rope thing, I saw an AI-generated photo of a knot in a rope and this was weeks ago and it sort of didn't occur to me until you just brought that up. And the knot was so unbelievable, like it's like a close-up of a knot done in a bit of sisal rope, and there is no way that knot exists because it would never hold itself. It's
it has trouble with that, right? And the reason I've called that on out particularly because I'm looking at martial arts stuff, right? And your karate belt, right? I don't think I've ever seen an AI generated image of a belt, a karate belt done properly. There's always like the knot's weird or there's an extra thing sticking out of it or something's wrong with it, right? And I've noticed it in other images as well as a result of, you know, knowing to look for that. So, yeah, just be on the lookout. And, of course, yeah, if you see anything like that, then just report it and unfollow groups that are posting that kind of content because it's just garbage.
Yeah, it most certainly is.
And to finish off the AI wars, we have Google Cloud debuts powerful new AI capabilities for data scientists and doctors. So we have a couple of new features available. Google Colab, which is a free cloud-based Jupyter notebook that developers use to write and execute Python-based code. Very nice. Yeah, today we're excited to bring data science agents to all Colab users. The feature allows you to generate complete working Colab notebooks from simple natural language descriptions. Pretty cool.
Yeah.
So that's kind of something that's available for AI data scientists. But then we also have, along with that, multimodal search for healthcare professionals. Now, this I thought was like, why didn't we already have this? Especially when you consider that healthcare, 90% of the medical data comes in image form, such as x-rays and photos, right?
Well, so I remember back when Bard was first released, and one of the guardrails that it had was no medical advice.
And I think Gemini still does that when you ask it for medical advice.
Mm.
And it just says, I'm a medical professional. And
there's evidently now a gateway into getting that medical data out that isn't available to normal, the plebs. Well,
this is in Vertex AI search. Hmm. So you would have to, you know, spin up your own instance and it'd be isolated, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
In that sense.
But I was just thinking, because the Gemini 2 model, which you'd spin up the notebook on, would still theoretically have that guardrail in place.
But I mean, it's a specific use case, so
maybe there is just
like if you're using this, there might be a terms like you have to be an actual clinical person, not just.
Yeah, that's right. So that sort of privacy would be in place, right?
You'd hope so. Yeah, yeah. It was just interesting. It was one of the things that I thought of when I was reading the article. Was hang on a second, Gemini is not allowed to give you medical advice, so. I wonder then that how they're getting, like that was one of the core guardrails that they had. So I wonder how they're then getting around that. Are they just saying, hey, this is a deployed for healthcare, so that guardrail doesn't.
Yeah. It's yeah, a, that, they remove that guardrail.
A set of Suricata rules where you can just omit that rule ID.
Yeah. And that PII wouldn't be going back into the model, right? They've trained that model with anonymized data initially, and now it can be used, and that you wouldn't feed that PII back in.
No. You can't legally.
No. And I think it's a great use case, right? Like why hold an X-ray up to a light and have someone look at it when they're looking for some sort of tumor, when you can just have an AI and they might miss it, right? And you just have an AI in there and it goes bang. Okay, that could be a problem.
Yeah, been helpful for my. Neurosurgeon yesterday finding the bone spurs on my spine.
Yeah, right. I thought you were going to say to find your brain.
No,
I probably need that.
that's long left the chat.
So the new multimodal search feature in Vertex AI Search for Healthcare, so it's a special version of Vertex AI, right? It's AI Search for Healthcare, will aid doctors, nurses, and other medical professions by providing them with a more comprehensive view of their patients' health. I guess the other use case is if you've got, a lot of medical history on a particular patient, you feed all that in and it can just pull it all together and go, oh, yeah, I've got all these photos, I've got all these x-rays, and I've got all this, you know, notes that the doctors take, and I put it all together and go, oh, okay, here's a future diagnosis. I know that in 5 years this is potentially going to happen. You need to act now on it, right?
I was just I just thought I might do a quick search for Google's AI for healthcare, and they actually have a separate model. So it's not it, while it might be based on Gemini, it's not actually Gemini's language model. It's MedLM. It's a family of models fine-tuned for the healthcare industry. So there you go.
There you go. There you go. All right. Well, we've investigated. We've checked. We've discussed.
Solved mysteries.
Solved mysteries. Figured out binary 42. I'm cooked. I'm done for the week. Yes.
I am too. I need to go and have some sleep.
Yeah.
Back to bed for you.
Yeah.
Go and lie down.
No, I've got to get on a plane again tomorrow.
Yeah, we'll get some rest between now and then. Don't forget, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music. Go to Apple Podcasts, write us a review to really help the show out. And while you're at YouTube, go there, smash that like button, and start the discussion as well. That would really help us propel us around YouTube. You can contact the show, contact@gcbbytes.com.au, and find us on the web, www.gcbbytes.com.au. And don't forget, today's sponsor are Hive Tech Solutions and Mantle Group. Once again, it's been another fantastic show, guys. You guys got anything else to add?
No, I'm done.
Yeah. That was a very definitive I'm done from Dave.
Yeah, all right. Well, you can catch us in a fortnight for more ramblings. See you. Bye.
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 So, I had to go to Sydney last week, right?
Hilarious.
Yeah. So, before I went
was
to Sydney...
Was this the trip you were going to drive past my place and pick
was,
up that
it
stuff?
It was the trip, but it just ended up not happening.
You popped down just dodging the cycle and you thought with Dutton and Vaklaus.
Objective days. So, anyway, I go down to Sydney and... I took Rosie's car to the airport. Now, I'd sent her out earlier the day before because we used to have like 8 extension cords here and I can't find a single one of them. Out of all of the extension cords we've got here, there's one sitting on the shelf and it's got no plug on the end of it. And I'm like,
it's wireless.
I don't know who's taken the plug off or what they've done with it, but I need to murder them. So anyway, my wife goes down to the hardware store, buys 4 new extension cords. Because we knew we were going to get a power outage.
Yep.
So I was like, right, need you to make sure that the generator is out of the shed because you can't get into the shed if there's no power. It's got roller doors on both sides. There's no door in it.
Slight oversight there.
Yeah, well. And then we'll... the extension cords we can just plug into the water pump and the fridges and freezers and that. And she's like, yep, no drama. So anyway, I jump in her car and take her car down to the airport because, you know, there's a cyclone coming and I'm not putting my brand new $110,000 patrol down at the airport. Which I think is fair.
And guess where the extension cords are?
And guess where the extension cords are? And I get this phone call going,
oh, yeah.
Guess where I left the extension cords? I'm like, in the back of the Mazda that I took to the airport, I'm guessing. And she's like, yeah. And so then I get home on the Wednesday night, and I didn't even think about the generator. I was like, no, I've said that it needs to come out of the shed, so I'm not going to bother asking because, you know, people get pissed off when I ask for something and then ask to see that it's done. So I ignored it. And then the power went out, and guess where the generator was? in the shed you can't get to. So here's me going, all right, the circuitry in this house is pretty old. Now there's a feed that goes from the house over to the little shed that then backs onto the big shed. So maybe I can isolate the shed from the house, and I've got a little tiny adapter plug that goes from 15 amp to 10 amp or 10 amp to 15 amp. So I'll take the plug off that, and I've got another lead that's got the socket on it, and I'll just put the plug on that socket. So I've got a plug-to-plug lead. Yeah? So I got two male ends. I'm going to plug one into the old generator.
Yeah.
Right? That's
you'll liven up the circuit.
And liven up the circuit and see if I can get power over to the big shed to open it up.
Yeah.
No. Someone replaced the circuit breaker there with one of the new fancy ones that's got an RCD built into the circuit breaker. Can't do that anymore. Right.
Can't do that anymore, no.
Backfeeding power apparently bad.
RCD says no.
Yeah. So I'm sitting there going, I have no way to get into the shed. My father-in-law is like, oh, well, why don't we just take a sheet of the cladding off the outside of it? And I was like, that would be a fantastic idea if I had a screw gun to do it with.
which are in the shed.
And he was like, where's your screw gun? And I'm like, it's in the shed where all of my stuff is. And then it was like, oh, we can just, I've got a pair of pliers here. And I'm like, there's 35 screws in each one of those sheets. And it is pissing
socket
with
set,
rain.
You know? Socket set would be in the shed, I imagine.
Yeah. So, no. No, we didn't get the generator out.
Right about that time, I'd be going, well, I'll just get my Leatherman, right? And that can do everything with my Leatherman. But where do I keep my Leatherman? In the console, in my truck, which would be in the shed.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, well, actually, my Leatherman is. It's sitting in my my little ammo box that I take to the range, because I always take my Leatherman to the range with me. Yeah, so it just sits in that box.
Yep.
And that's sitting on top of my gun safe, which is sitting in the shed.
Completely hosed.